It was just another morning. The Florida sun was creeping up, birds making a racket outside, and the smell of coffee filled the house. Marlene was finishing up the dishes, half listening to the radio when the doorbell rang. I was in the other room, flipping through the morning paper, sipping my coffee, when I heard her footsteps heading toward the door. I heard her twisting the doorknob, followed by a creak. Somebody's at the door, probably a delivery guy, I assumed. But then, I didn't hear anyone speaking. The silence prevailed for 4 to 5 awkward seconds, and suddenly, a loud bang numbed my eardrums. I shot up from my chair, my heart slamming against my ribs as I ran to the door. And there she was, my wife, my beautiful Marlene, sprawled out on the floor, blood everywhere, her head twisted at an unnatural angle. Her face, Jesus, her face. The hole where her eye used to be was just a dark, gory mess, blood soaking into the carpet and pooling around her body. Her mouth moved slightly like she was trying to say something, but no sound came, just those last rattling breaths and her trembling body. And then I saw it, the clown. It wasn't moving, just standing there, watching, holding a bouquet and 2 balloons, one of them red. The makeup was perfect, too perfect. The exaggerated red lips curved into a wide, unnatural smile. It wasn't even a smile, rather, a deadly, horrific grin. The eyes, God, the eyes, they were black, empty pits. It stood too still, too calm, like it wasn't even real. Like it was something out of a nightmare that had seeped into reality. My whole body went cold. The air felt thick, like something pressing against my chest, making it hard to breathe. Joe's scream rang out behind me. My son, my goddamn son, running to his mother, slipping in her blood, trying to hold her broken face together like he could stop the life from leaking out of her. His hands trembled as he touched her, his fingers slipping over the raw, ruined flesh, his hands getting all wet from his mother's blood. I couldn't move, couldn't breathe. The world was spinning. The clown, slow as anything, turned, walked down the driveway, climbed into a car like it hadn't just killed my wife, as if it was just a daily chore. The balloons bobbed in the air as the car pulled away. I stood there, frozen, watching them drift higher and higher, disappearing into the bright morning sky. But the image of that painted face, the way it grinned at me before leaving, burned itself into my brain. The cops came fast. They took one look at Marlene and started talking about a robbery gone wrong, some freak accident. But I knew this wasn't random. Somebody planned this. Somebody wanted her dead. For years, I grieved. I drank. I sat in that house, hearing the echoes of that gunshot every time I closed my eyes. People talked. Some whispered that I had something to do with it, that my business, my dealings weren't exactly clean. But none of that mattered. My wife was dead, and the killer was a ghost. And then there was Sheila. She had been in my life before Marlene died. It started as something small, something secret, a thrill, a mistake I told myself that didn't mean anything. But Sheila wanted more, and Marlene was in the way. We got closer after Marlene's murder. We fell in love for real. We built a life together, got married, opened a restaurant. She made me believe I could start over. She made me believe I was safe. And then, after all those years, the cops showed up at our door. DNA evidence, new forensic testing, the truth dragged into the light. The woman I had loved, the woman I had trusted, Sheila Keen Warren, had pulled the trigger that day. She had dressed up like a nightmare, knocked on my door, handed Marlene those flowers, and shot her in the goddamn face. All I remember is that when the cops were taking her, the words that came out of her mouth were,
"I hated that woman. You are mine. You always were. I despised her." Michael, you are mine.
I couldn't process it, couldn't understand it. I sat through the trial in a daze, but Sheila, she barely reacted. No remorse, no fear, no regret. She sat there, calm, like it was just another day, like none of this even mattered. And when they read her charges, she smiled. That same wide, unnatural grin, just like the clown. 12 years. That's it. 12 goddamn years for what she did. 12 years for walking into my home, for putting a bullet through Marlene's head while she smiled. But there was something worse. The way she looked at me, even after all those years, after all that pretending, like she still had some kind of control, like she still owed me. And in a way, maybe she did. Because I had spent so long in her shadow, loving her, believing in her, that I didn't even see the monster staring back at me every night. And me? I live with it. I live with the knowledge that I kissed the lips of a woman who took Marlene's last breath, that I built a future with the same hands that held that gun, that every memory I had with her was built on blood. Some nights I wake up gasping, feeling like I'm suffocating. And sometimes in the quiet of the house, when the wind howls through the trees, I hear it. The squeak of oversized shoes, the rustle of balloons. And I swear to God, if I turn too fast, I'll see it. Those orange curls, that frozen painted grin, those dead painted eyes staring right at me. Marlene never saw it coming, but maybe I should have. Because I know I am the one who's actually responsible for my wife's death. I cheated, but she suffered the consequences. The Marlene Warren case is a decades-long murder mystery that finally saw justice after over 30 years. On May 26, 1990, 40-year-old Marlene Warren was shot in the face at her front door in Wellington, Florida, by a person dressed as a clown, carrying balloons and flowers. The killer then calmly walked away and drove off in a Chrysler LeBaron. Suspicion soon fell on Sheila Keene Warren, who was rumored to have been having an affair with Marlene's husband, Michael Warren. However, at the time, authorities lacked sufficient evidence to make an arrest. The case went cold until 2014, when DNA and advancements in forensic science linked Sheila to the crime. In 2017, she was arrested in Virginia, where she had been living with Michael Warren, whom she married right after Marlene's death. Sheila Keene Warren was charged with first-degree murder, but pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of second-degree murder in 2023 as part of a plea deal. She was sentenced to 12 years in prison, with credit for time served, allowing for an imminent release. The case remains infamous as the killer clown murder, a chilling tale of deception, love affairs, and delayed justice. It was just like any other call, just another homicide in the dark underbelly of Beverly Hills. The dispatcher's voice crackled through my car radio. Two deceased, 722 North Elm Drive, possible home invasion. No urgency, no tremor, just another night, another crime. When I arrived, the Menendez mansion loomed before me, a pristine facade concealing an atrocity. The moment I stepped inside, the air was thick, suffocating. Gunpowder, blood, something foul and sickly sweet mixed in, a scent that would cling to my skin for days. The bodies were in the living room. The coroner was already there, shaking his head as he zipped up the second bag. Jose Menendez's body was barely recognizable. His head, or what was left of it, was a gaping hole, skull shattered into jagged shards, brain matter splattered across the couch, dripping in thick, slimy clumps. His chest looked like someone had taken a sledgehammer to it. Buckshot had ripped straight through, exposing broken ribs and raw, torn muscle. Blood wasn't just on the floor, it was everywhere. On the walls and on the ceiling, the expensive Persian rug was soaked like spilled ink. His fingers, twisted and curled, were locked into a final spasm of agony, as if he had been trying to claw himself back from death. Kitty Menendez had suffered even worse. She had tried to run. Her body was sprawled across the floor in a grotesque pose, her limbs bent at unnatural angles. The first shot had exploded her kneecap, leaving nothing but a mess of shattered bone and tendon. Another had ripped through her shoulder, the flesh peeling back like raw meat. The last shots were to her face. What had once been a woman was now a pulp of mangled skin, empty sockets where her eyes had been, her jaw blown clean off, leaving behind a yawning, gory cavity. The sheer brutality of the attack didn't just speak of rage. It screamed of something unhinged, something feral. Then there were the sons. Lyle and Eric Menendez arrived at the scene in hysterics, their screams piercing the night air. Eric collapsed onto the neatly trimmed lawn, his body racked with violent, jerking sobs. His face contorted between terror and some twisted, unreadable emotion. Lyle clutched at his own hair, his fingers digging into his scalp so hard I thought he might rip it out. His mouth moved silently before sound finally escaped. Raw, broken wails.
"Oh my God, they're dead! They're dead!"
he shrieked, his voice cracked into something that wasn't quite human. His eyes were wide, bulging, glistening with tears, but there was something else in them, something off, something calculating. "Just tell us what happened," I said, trying to keep my voice steady.
"I'm breaking,"
Lyle gasped, his chest heaving.
"We went to the movies, and when we came back, oh God, oh God, oh God."
Eric buried his face in his hands, nails raking down his cheeks so hard I expected to see blood. It seemed plausible. Beverly Hills wasn't immune to crime, but something was wrong. The way Lyle's sobs would cut off abruptly like he was checking our reactions, the way Eric's wails felt too practiced. For months, the case went cold. No forced entry, no suspects. But then, the brothers started spending. They weren't grieving sons. They were predators set loose. Rolex watches, luxury cars, designer suits. Eric hired a full-time tennis coach. Lyle bought a restaurant. Their spending spree totaled hundreds of thousands of dollars. It stank of guilt, of arrogance, of boys who thought they had gotten away with it. But guilt does strange things to people. Eric cracked first. Dr. Jerome Oziel, a name I will never forget. Eric, racked with anxiety, had confessed everything to his therapist. In hushed, shaking whispers, he described that night. The moment they crept up behind their parents, the cold steel of the shotgun was heavy in their hands. He spoke of his father's startled expression, turning to horror as the first shot tore through him, of his mother's screams ripping through the house. He told Oziel about the way she had crawled, her nails scratching the hardwood, and that she had reached out to him, her own son, for mercy, and how he had pulled the trigger again and again until there was nothing left of her face but a wet, pulpy mess of bone and flesh. And then he spoke of what came before. He spoke of the nights when Jose would creep into his room, a shadowed figure silhouetted in the dim glow of the hallway light, of how he would press a heavy hand over Eric's mouth, muffling the whimpers as he whispered threats, promises of pain if he ever spoke. He described the disgusting, suffocating feeling of his father's weight crushing him, the sickening warmth of his breath on his skin, the way the door would creak shut, trapping him in the darkness, in that horror, night after night. Lyle's story was worse. He had been the first. He had suffered longer. He talked about the beatings, the welts, the bruises that never healed, the way his father would laugh, a cold, cruel sound when he flinched, the way his mother did nothing, just sat there, drinking herself into oblivion while her sons were being ripped apart. He told the court how he would lie awake, staring at the ceiling, waiting for the footsteps, waiting for the nightmare to begin again. How he would watch his little brother suffer the same fate. How the rage built inside him, seething, festering, until it finally exploded into something unstoppable. Dr. Oziel had hesitated, bound by patient confidentiality. He told no one at first, but then he told his mistress, Judalon Smith, and she told us. We arrested the brothers in March 1990. Lyle fought, Eric didn't. The trial that followed was a descent into something even darker than murder. The jury couldn't decide. The first trial ended in a deadlock. The second, in 1996, stripped them of their defense. The verdict was swift, guilty of first-degree murder, life in prison, no parole. Justice, some called it. Others called it a tragedy. Years later, I still don't know what to believe. I know they planned it. I know they executed it. But I also know the look of a victim. And Eric Menendez had the eyes of someone who had lived through hell. Even now, sometimes I drive past that house. It's changed hands many times. But to me, it will always be soaked in blood. Sometimes I think I see shadows in the windows, lingering figures of the past. Maybe it's just my imagination. Or maybe some ghosts never rest. The Menendez brothers, Lyle and Eric, were convicted for the 1989 murders of their wealthy parents, Jose and Kitty Menendez, in their Beverly Hills home. Initially, the brothers claimed they were innocent, but later admitted to the killings, arguing they acted in self-defense after years of alleged abuse. The prosecution maintained they murdered for financial gain. Their first trial ended in a deadlock, but in 1996, they were retried, convicted of first-degree murder, and sentenced to life in prison without parole. The case remains controversial, with ongoing debates over their motives and claims of abuse influencing public opinion. The camera crew sets up, their equipment humming, and the harsh white lights make the prison walls seem even more lifeless. The journalist clears his throat, adjusting his recorder. He's trying to mask his nerves, but I see the way his fingers tremble slightly as he clicks his pen. The red recording light blinks. "Ready?" he asks, his voice steady but unsure. I nod. My throat is dry, my palms clammy. And then, just like that, I'm back there. It was hot that night, the air thick, damp, pressing down like an unseen weight, the kind of night that makes your skin itch, that makes the world feel wrong. Skylar was so happy. She sat in the back seat, smiling, laughing, oblivious. She had no idea. She talked about the future, about college, about how we'd always stay together. Her voice was light, full of dreams. It almost made me hesitate. Almost. She slipped out her window at midnight, hoodie pulled over her head, slipping into the car like she always did. She smelled like vanilla perfume. I remember that. We drove deep into the woods. The road stretched endlessly, the trees closing in on us. The headlights cast long shadows, stretching and bending like something was lurking within them.
"Sheila, do you have a lighter?"
I asked, my voice barely a whisper. That was the signal. Sheila nodded. Skylar turned away for just a second, searching the ground. And that's when we struck. I plunged the knife into her side. The blade sliced through her skin like butter, sinking deep, cutting muscle, tearing through organs. Hot blood sprayed across my hands, sticky and thick. Skylar gasped, her mouth opening in shock before it twisted into agony. She shrieked a raw, ear-piercing sound. Her hands flew to the wound, her fingers trembling as they touched the deep gash in her side. Blood pulsed between them, spilling down her hoodie, soaking into the fabric, turning it dark and wet. She staggered forward, her knees buckling, but Sheila was on her before she could even process what was happening. The next stab went into her back, a crunch, then a wet squelch. Sheila yanked the blade out, and Skylar collapsed to her knees, shaking violently. Blood poured out of her, pooling around her on the dirt, sinking into the earth. Her eyes locked onto mine, wide with confusion and betrayal. Her lips trembled, forming words she couldn't get out. Her breaths came in ragged gasps, thick with blood, each one weaker than the last. But she wouldn't die. She wouldn't stop moving.
"She's still breathing,"
Sheila hissed, wiping the blood off her face with the back of her hand. Skylar tried to crawl away, her fingers clawing at the dirt, nails breaking off as she struggled to drag herself forward. I stepped over her, lifting the knife high. My heart pounded, my vision blurred, my hands were slick, the handle of the knife almost slipping from my grip. Then I brought it down, straight into her neck. Her body spasmed violently, her mouth opening in a silent scream. Blood sprayed, warm and thick, coating my face and dripping down my arms. Her throat gurgled, a horrible wet sound as she tried to breathe, drowning in her own blood. Sheila kicked her onto her back. Skylar's body twitched, her chest rising and falling unevenly, her eyes rolling back. She was still alive.
Finish it.
Sheila spat. I didn't think, I just stabbed. Over and over and over. Each thrust tearing through flesh, slicing veins, hitting bone. Blood sprayed up, hitting my face, my clothes, my skin. It was everywhere. The body beneath me twitched once, then stopped. The forest was silent. The smell of blood filled the air, thick and suffocating. The pool of red around Skylar seeped into the earth, soaking the dirt and covering my shoes, my hands, and my face. My heartbeat pounded in my ears, deafening. We had planned to bury her, but the ground was too hard. The shovel barely scraped the surface. It didn't matter anyway. There was too much blood. It was everywhere. So we left her there. We covered her with leaves and branches, but her hands still stuck out, fingers stiffening in the night air, nails caked with dirt and flesh. Her face was barely hidden beneath the foliage, eyes lifeless, mouth frozen in a silent plea. We got back into the car. The seats were soaked red. My hands wouldn't stop shaking. My clothes, my face drenched in blood. The scent clung to me and seeped into my pores. I could taste it on my tongue. We drove home in silence. My head was pounding. I could still hear it in my ears. Choking, gasping, bones cracking under the weight of our knives. For months, we acted like nothing happened. We posted her pictures online and handed out missing posters with our blood-stained hands. We cried in front of the cameras, hugged her parents, lied to their faces. But I heard her every night. Her screams echoed in my ears, her bloodied hands reaching for me in the darkness, her mouth twisted in agony. I felt the weight of her body under mine, her flesh splitting beneath my hands. It wouldn't go away. So I cracked. I told them everything. The trial was fast. The world recoiled. They called us monsters. Sheila tried to act tough in court, but I saw it. The fear in her eyes. She knew. She got life. No way out. I got 30 years. Parole in 10. Skylar got a shallow grave in the woods where no one could hear her scream. I was lost in the trauma when the interviewer brought me back to reality. The journalist looked pale, his hands gripping the table, knuckles white. He clears his throat, voice barely above a whisper. Do you regret it? I don't answer right away. I let the question hang in the air like the stench of blood that will never wash off my hands. I meet his gaze.
Every single day.
The red light blinks. The interview is over, but my nightmare will never end. Skylar Neese, a 16-year-old from West Virginia, had two best friends, Sheila Eddy and Rachel Showoff. One night, the trio went out for a late-night drive, but it was a trap. Sheila and Rachel stabbed Skylar to death, leaving her body in the woods. The killers acted normal for months, even helping in the search for Skylar. Rachel later cracked under guilt and confessed, leading to Sheila's arrest. The reason the killers gave was that they didn't want to be friends with her anymore. Rachel got 30 years, eligible for parole in 10. Sheila got life in prison with parole eligibility after 15 years. They were best friends. Skylar had no idea she was walking to her own execution.